Welcome to Curated Conversations from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, bringing you the best events each week from the world's number one defense and national security think tank. To explore the hundreds of events we host each year, visit us at csis.org.
Okay.
Great. Good morning, everyone. It's great to welcome you to CSIS. I'm Michael Matera. I'm the director of the Americas program here. We have to start off all of our public programs with an announcement on safety. I am the safety officer. If there is an emergency, follow me, and I'll be running down the stairs. In a recent World Economic Forum poll carried out globally, Latin America was the one region in the world where corruption was identified as the most serious threat to democracy and to economic progress. In many countries in the Americas, corruption has for a very long time been a way of life in all branches of government as well as within the business community. Increasingly, as we know, organized crime is now finding its way into this system. One subregion of Latin America that is especially impacted by corruption, weak institutions, and high levels of violence is the Northern Triangle countries of Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. The costs of corruption in these countries, where homicides, extortion, and kidnapping are among the worst in the world, range in estimates from 5% to as high as 13% of GDP. Here at CSIS, less than a year ago, we launched a project on transparency. Our project is doing research on the way corruption has been addressed in both the public and private sectors in the region, specifically in Chile, Uruguay, and Colombia, which far outrank the rest of Latin America in terms of their ranking on World Bank rankings. We are identifying best practices in Chile, Colombia, and Uruguay in several areas: political party and campaign finance controls, government procurement, management of fiscal resources, civil service reform, and the overarching issue of impunity. We are focusing on how some of the best practices from the countries I've already mentioned might be relevant and useful in addressing corruption in the countries of the Northern Triangle. One reason why corruption appears to be a bigger problem than ever is because of the increasingly active role that civil society and the press have played in exposing corrupt individuals and institutions. We have with us this morning Ricardo Barrientos, the senior economist from one of the most important and effective of these civil society organizations in Central America. ICEFI, the Central American Institute for Fiscal Studies, has done impressive work on uncovering and documenting how corruption has found its way into most levels of the political, economic, and social systems of the Northern Triangle countries. A seminal report that ICEFI did a little bit more than a year ago on those three countries, I have used as my Bible on transparency and anti-corruption. So most of what I know today is because of your organization, Ricardo. In its latest report on the costs of corruption in Guatemala, this is going to be the subject of our presentation today. Joining Mr. Barrientos are two very distinguished experts on Latin America. First, Ambassador Todd Robinson has had a long career with the State Department, including about 6 years, 5 years in Guatemala. He was ambassador to Guatemala from 2014 to 2017, and also served two earlier years as DCM. So I would wager to say there are a few people who know Guatemala in our Foreign Service as well as Todd. He was known for his outspoken and no-nonsense approach to corruption and transparency wherever he served. He's now working as senior advisor on Central America at the State Department. Ambassador Robinson will comment on the presentation by Mr. Barrientos. Mark Schneider is a senior advisor here at the Americas program, and he's leading our transparency project. He's been involved for years in Central and South America. He began his career as a Peace Corps volunteer in El Salvador, worked for many years on the Hill with Senator Kennedy, was the USAID Assistant Administrator for Latin America, Executive Director of the Peace Corps, and He's had a number of other distinguished positions over the years. Mark and I were in Guatemala and El Salvador just a couple of weeks ago doing work on the project. With that brief introduction, I'd like to turn the floor over to Mark Schneider, who will moderate our program.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks, Mark. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to move right now to allow Ricardo to present the findings of his very impressive study. I will say, just in terms of additional background, Ricardo also, in addition to his role with ESEFI, has been Vice Minister of Transparency and Fiscal Evaluation in the Finance Ministry in Guatemala. He was has worked with the Inter-American Development Bank and focused on particularly on tax issues within Central America, and also has worked in the Secretariat of Planning and Programming of the Guatemalan Presidency in the past. I'm going to let Ricardo begin the presentation.
Thank you very much. I'm going to use the podium because I want to. I need to see
we
what I'm
see.
Talking about. Well, good morning to all. First, I want to say thank you very much to the CSIS for hosting this presentation. Thank you very much to Ambassador Robinson for offering us his comments and for Mark Schneider. So, believe it or not, in Guatemala, there is a stiff debate on about if fighting corruption is good or not. And the first stance, from common sense or an ethical point of view, there is no discussion about it. But there are arguments about it. Let me see if this is going to work and this not. Maybe a little bit of help. There you go. It was off. Okay. So our motivation here is to address this debate, but from a different point of view. There had been a lot of comments in Guatemala saying that fighting corruption and impunity has a negative impact, a negative fiscal impact. For example, may I quote Mr. Francisco Beltranena, which said on television, "What the fight against corruption has brought is an economic slowdown. The economy is a mess. GDP, foreign investment, bank credit, the main economic variables, stalemating. Only migration is increasing. It's crazy to believe that making the same mistakes will bring different results. No more lawfare." This is a well-respected Guatemalan economist, José Raúl González Merlo, in a tweet. And there are more and more comments on this, scholars, politicians, but there are many, many arguments in favor of fighting against corruption and impunity. Sergio Recinos, the acting president of the Central Bank, said fighting corruption improves a country's economy and makes it to grow. The lowering of sovereign ratings was aggravated by the president's failed attempt to expel CC commissioner from the country. And this was Standard & Poor's credit ratings. A corruption-free economy will bring more investment, not less. It should be made clear that Mr. Morales' war with CC is putting financial aid at risk, The Economist. And US investments reflect confidence in a Guatemala that fights corruption. And this is Mr. Arriaga, current US ambassador in Guatemala. So there are, in fact, a debate. Many arguments in favor, many arguments against the fight against corruption. So what we did is, okay, let's try to analyze what are the data, what are the technical support for these arguments. And what we found is that many were
plain opinions without a study that can back up or sustain what these people are saying. So trying to be neutral, what we try to do is to make some fancy econometric models and try to run and test the hypothesis that fighting corruption is hurting, for example, budget execution capabilities or is favoring economic growth. So the first thing to say is that ISEFI, of course, recognizes that Guatemala economies, in fact, has slowed down. As the graph shows, in 2014, economic growth was 4.2%, and in 2016, 3.1%, and 2017, 2.8%. So GDP growth decelerated. That is a fact. So the discussion is about what are the factors that technically can explain this behavior. And we tested many, many factors, around 12, including fighting against corruption. And what we found is that this economic slowdown is explained mainly by six factors. Three of them closed with public finance, and the other three more of a macroeconomic nature. The first of them is public spending austerity. Guatemala has one of the world's lowest budgets, public budgets. Central government is spending around 13% of GDP, and of course, budgeting less public spending contributes to economic slowdown. So small budgets, it's an significantly explaining factor about this economic slowdown. The second one is low budgetary execution. And this is quite important because many, many of the arguments is that when in 2015, the Public Prosecutor Office and CC started to present cases to the courts, so every public official now is afraid to put his or her signature in a contract. Maybe that argument has some value in 2015, but now, 3 years later of that, even with the reforms to the public procurement law, offering more efficient, transparent, and easy ways to for public contracting, this explanation about the fear is falling apart. It is more on capabilities to execute the public budget. And the main problem is especially in public infrastructure, public investment in infrastructure. And this is really falling very, very low. In 2014, the government executed around 79% of its public investment budget. But in 2015, it executed almost only half of it. And in 2016, less than half of the public budget. And this doesn't have anything to do with fear or with complications of the public procurement. It's only, for example, the current administration has changed four times the Ministry of Public Works. So a lot of public officials without experience and knowledge on how to do public procurement, especially in public investment, is one of the main factors for it. So this is one of the very, very highlights that we found in this econometric tests. The third one is a very well known for Guatemala. The tax administration's inability to collect more taxes, to raise the tax burden. Guatemala has, if not the lowest tax burden on comparable countries that has not, like Panama with the canal or Mexico with the oil industry, one of the lowest tax burdens around the world. So despite tax amnesties that almost every year the current administration has offered to the taxpayers, tax collection is insufficient for funding more public spending and investment. So the government has two structural problems to execute more public investment. One is institutional capabilities to execute the polling, to execute the contracts. And second, it doesn't have more money to raise the public investment that will contribute to boost the economic growth. So these three are more of related to public finance. The fourth is inflation. International oil prices have been rising, so higher prices in the domestic market reduces consumption, and consumption is the main component of Guatemalan GDP. If consumption is slowing down, the whole economy is slowing down. So this is a direct impact of increasing prices. The fifth is the component of bank credit to the private sector. This has been declining over the recent years, and this is a very important because, as you can see in the graph, the decline is quite notorious and steep. There are two reasons for this behavior. First, investors were cautious about and demanded less bank credit because of the political instability. So this has a link with fighting corruption. When investors see a president, see a government that is resisting or is fighting the public prosecutor office or CICIG, then this creates instability, political instability. And we have a very recent, and Mr. Ambassador Robinson well know this case of Presidente Pérez Molina, which started to fight against the effort against corruption. And what happens? He ended in a temporary prison and is facing many trials because of corruption. But that created instability. Another clear example, quite recent and quite dramatic, is Nicaragua. What happened with the touristic industry in Nicaragua? It fell apart totally. So investors are cautious on political instability, and when we have the president himself fighting the public prosecutor office, the Ministerio Público, and CICIG, that is not well received at the investors' community. And that is one line that has been clearly stated by Standard & Poor's, by Moody's, but all the credit rated agencies that look and analyze Guatemala. And the other reason is that banks prefer buy foreign and treasury bonds rather than lend to companies. And this is a question of macroeconomic nature and the interest rate in Guatemala. But the sixth and last of the significant explaining factors for this economic slowdown is the exchange rate between the national currency, the quetzal, and the US dollar. The quetzal has been experiencing a nominal appreciation. So this is to say that quetzal has been stronger than the US dollar in the money markets and the exchange rate. And this situation is hurting the Guatemalan exports, which is one of the most important lines in the Guatemalan GDP. So, in conclusion, these are from all the possible explaining factors that we tested that the econometric tool showed as significantly as relevant. So, in addition to that, so one first main conclusion is that fighting corruption and impunity was not among those relevant and significant factors explaining the slowdown. So we cannot say from the data, from the technical analysis, that really fighting corruption, fighting impunity in Guatemala is hurting the economy or is preventing the government to execute the budget. The reasons are others. In addition, the economic slowdown is not an exclusive issue of Guatemala. It's a regional phenomenon that is going on. So in recent years, economic growth has slowed in all Central American countries, with the exception of Honduras. And of course, you know this better than us, US economic growth has also slowed since 2015, with some signs of recovery in this 2018. But in 2015, 2016, and 2017, the economic growth in the US has slowed down, which is quite relevant for our study, because the US is the main trade partner of the Central American region. So US and Central America as a group and are Guatemalan main trade partners. So the fight against corruption in Guatemala could not possibly slow down the economic performance of other countries and other regions. If Ministerio Público and CICIG work could hurt the Guatemalan other economies, then that will be a power that really should be a cause of concern, which is not, of course. Then we found another thing. Fighting corruption and impunity in Guatemala is a very specific action in a very short term. It started in 2015, while economic slowdown is more linked with structural characteristics of the Guatemalan economy. So what we do in this study is to read carefully the 2017 Monetary Exchange and Credit Policy Evaluation and Economics Outlook for 2018 made by the Central Bank of Guatemala. So this is a way that is not ISEFI saying these sort of things. It's the Central Bank, the top authority in monetary exchange rate and economic policies. And what this central bank study says is that capital has not contributed to domestic economic growth for 67 years. So problem of how capital and investment drives the economic growth in Guatemala has not been heard by the fighting against corruption and impunity since 2015. It has a long history of structural problems. That is, the low levels of public and private investment are a structural characteristic of the Guatemalan economy. So the Guatemalan economic slowdown in 2017 can therefore not explainably solely by short-term factors as fighting against corruption and impunity. So we should take in account that maybe if we are concerned about economic slowdown, instead of trying to hammering and fight Ministerio Público and CICIG, maybe we should look at the economic fundamentals of Guatemala and the structure of the whole economy, which is where the economic policies should be pointing out. Well, oops, sorry. I don't know what I did. There you go. So beyond 2015 and 2017, we in the study try to look at the relationship between the fight against corruption and the economy. Is there a relationship? And if there is a relationship, what kind of relation is this? Is a positive one, that fighting against corruption helps economic growth, or is a negative one that hurts economic growth? Which, I repeat, we try to be neutral in answering this, not from an ethical point of view, but from the data, trying to find what the numbers say. And from this strictly technical standpoint, we consider two hypothetical positions. And you can be surprised that these two hypothetical positions indeed can be found in the theoretical economic literature. First, is that corruption is harmful for economic growth and development. That is common sense, right? But there are many scholars and very serious economists that say that a little of corruption is beneficial. It makes more efficiency by reducing the cost of bureaucracies, red tape, and cumbersome things. So there are books written by very serious scholars. So we try to follow their ideas and try to test these two hypotheses with the Guatemalan data and other countries' data. So we research with technical economic rigor the relationship between corruption or the fight against corruption and the economy. And the main result is the one dictated by common sense. In Guatemala, the fight against corruption is good for economic growth. What a surprise, right? So, how we can reach to this surprising and not very new conclusion? Well, we use an econometric tool, an econometric model that we input into it official data on macroeconomic variables published by the central bank and the public finance ministry, and the Guatemala's ranking on the corruption perceptions index prepared by TI, the Transparency International. So this is the technical exercise. With this economic tool, including some dummy variables, ISEFI analyzed the annual effect of over economic growth of the following factors: corruption, measured by the TI CPI, inflation, trade openness, sum of imports and exports, public spending as a percentage of GDP, and population growth. And what we found is that this economic tool revealed that corruption is a significant factor. Prices are not that significant because inflation is not that high. International trade, public spending, and population growth are significant factors. So, in what sense we should understand the conclusion that I mentioned earlier? In what sense is corruption a significant factor in economic growth? Technical economic analysis revealed in Guatemala, more corruption, less economic growth, or more fight against corruption, more economic growth. And this graph that looks like as a toy or something quite simple is the actual data. So this is the actual regression line that the model produced, and it clearly shows that economic growth is hurt by corruption. If more corruption, less economic growth. And this is the actual result from the econometric model. So what are the transmission channels of corruption hurting the Guatemalan economy? Well, what we did is that we repeated the analysis with the econometric model to study the relationship between corruption and current public spending and public and private investment. In this exercise, we found that investment is the main transmission channel of the harmful effects of corruption. And this is no surprise, because common sense also suggests that the main area of corruption is precisely investment. That is, the study led to the conclusion that public and private investment is the most severely harmed by corruption, or equivalently, investment is the most benefit by fight against corruption. And this started to sign as a public policy. Since in Guatemalan fundamentals, in the Guatemalan economy structure, investment is a problem that the central bank identified for 67 years, then we should improve investment. And one way precisely to improve investment is to reduce corruption, because corruption is hurting severely investment. So all the pieces of the game started to put together. Moreover, we try to establish the link between corruption and competitiveness, investment attraction, job creation. And according with the Global Competitive Index, Guatemala ranks 84 out of 137 economies. In 2016, it ranked 78. The lowest scores in this ranking were obtained in the following pillars: innovation, art, and institutions. And what is the problem with innovation and institutions? The categories that received the lowest scores under the institutions pillar were ethics and corruption in the public sector, 2.6 out of 7. Undue influence in the public sector, 3 out of 7. Public sector performance, that is a capability to execute budgets, 3 out of 7. Security, 3.1. Corporate ethics, 3.5. So this index maps where are the problems and where is corruption touching the country's ability to perform better in its economy. In the 2017-2018 Global Competitive Report, the consulted business people stated that the two most problematic factors out of 16 for doing business are not income tax, are crime and theft, which is a problem in the whole region, and corruption. Therefore, corruption, of course, harms competitiveness. The fight against corruption makes people more willing to start a business or invest, which enhances economic growth. These are not new things, but we are collecting all this data that even the businesswomen, businessmen are saying in these surveys. So, in conclusion, perhaps our main finding: fight against corruption in Guatemala enhances economic activity. And it's kind of curious that even we have to come to Washington, D.C. and have this event to say this, because it's against common sense. But as I started, there is a stiff debate on it. And there is even theoretical economic authors that are saying the contrary. So we feel that we had to test this with the data, with the statistics, with the surveys. Investment, a key factor for economic growth, is the most benefit from fight against corruption. Guatemala's economic growth has indeed slowed, but not because fighting corruption and impunity. And this should be a very, very sound conclusion that we should accept. Thus, Guatemala's economic slowdown of 2017 cannot be explained by short-term factors, such as the fight against corruption and impunity that started in 2015. The economic slowdown is not an exclusive Guatemalan phenomenon, but rather a regional Central American one. The fight against corruption in Guatemala could not slow down the economic performance of other countries, including the US, of course. I am pretty sure that Mr. Trump is sure about that. So thank you very much for giving us this moment of attention. Again, thank you very much for CSIS for hosting all. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm not going to speak too long, but I agree with Ricardo that the fact that we have to have a forum here to debate whether or not we should be fighting corruption is only a little maddening. The presentation was excellent. The one thing I would posit is the fight against corruption, of course, in Guatemala didn't start in 2015. People will remember, you all will remember that between 2004 and 2007, Guatemala was in a bad way. There were actors in Guatemala that were influencing the government, influencing political parties, not paying their taxes, as we found out later in 2015, undermining institutions. Corruption undermines institutions. In 2004, Guatemalan society reached what they considered at that point rock bottom and said, we need help. And they asked the United Nations for help, which is significant today because one of the first statements, I know his name by AMLO, the president-elect for Mexico, López Obrador. One of his first statements was that he's going to ask the United Nations to help him do what? Fight against corruption in Mexico. He's asking an international organization to help him. It's the first time. I don't think people can understand the significance of a Mexican president making a statement asking for international help to fight against corruption in Mexico. Huge. That all starts in 2004 with Guatemala. When the government of Guatemala asked the United Nations and came to an agreement by a treaty between the country of Guatemala and the United Nations and the United Nations to help them fight against corruption. The system in Guatemala was corrupt, is corrupt, and will be corrupt for a while. You know, corruption, there's not, every country deals with corruption. We deal with corruption in the United States all the time. There's no point where you're all of a sudden corruption free. But there can be consequences for that corruption. And that's one of the things, the combination of the Ministerio Público and CICIG did in 2014 and 2015. They set out the consequences for participating in corruption with the help of the international community. And I might add, while the United States is a major supporter of CICIG, it's not the only supporter of CICIG. There are European countries that support CICIG. Sweden is a huge supporter of CICIG. Germany is a supporter of CICIG. There's a reason for this, because we understand what corruption is doing, not just in Guatemala, in Honduras. The reason they have a maxi today is because they're fighting the same kind of corruption we were fighting in Guatemala. There's an attorney general, an intrepid attorney general in El Salvador that has to go around the country with security. Security from the government that named him, and security from the government that came before them, because he's fighting corruption. People say I'm outspoken. How can you not be outspoken about the fight against corruption? Look at what happened in Guatemala between 2014 and 2017. Presidents in jail, vice presidents in jail. Half the Congress is either in jail or a fugitive from justice. Half the cabinet is either in jail or a fugitive from justice. Businesses are admitting they weren't paying their taxes. Perfect example. One of the largest companies in Guatemala, Aceros de Guatemala, I think it's a scrap metal company. When the tax authority showed up at their door and asked to see their books, they said no. And for the first time in 2015, the tax authority said, Fine. We're going to keep our agents here until you show us your books. And if you don't, we're going to send the board of directors to jail. 2 days later, less than a week, they write a check to the government of Guatemala that essentially pays the entire debt for a year for the country, for the country. This is huge. First time ever. First time ever. Why? Because there are consequences for corruption. This is what CSIC has done. This is what the international community has been able to do, and only with valiant, courageous Guatemalans that were willing to take this thing on. Groups like ESEFI, the Attorney General's Office, the Tax Authority. This is important stuff. You know, we talk in the United States about threats to our national security. We're worried about terrorism. We're worried about drug trafficking. We're worried about money going one direction and arms going in another direction. We're worried about illegal migration in the United States. All of those things are fed by corruption. All of those things are fed by corruption. All of those things involve money that go to government officials that look the other way to give you a passport or some other document, that look the other way when planes are flying in from Venezuela with drugs and going the other way with money. They look the other way when arms are going in one direction and money is going in the other direction. The fight against corruption is everything in Central America. It's everything in Central America. If we can break the back of corruption in Central America, game changer. It's a game changer. It will, as we've seen, improve economies, jobs for people. Guatemalans don't want to come to the United States. They have to come to the United States because there are no jobs in Guatemala. There's no investment in Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador. People are going to go, if they're desperate, people are going to go where they can make lives better for their families. And if we can break the back of corruption in Central America, and I think we can, I think they're on the run. These people are sitting in jail now in Guatemala and in Honduras and in El Salvador today, desperate. And the proof of that is that we are sitting here in this room debating whether or not the fight against corruption is the right thing to do. Are you kidding me? Thank you.
I think I'm just going to sit here and raise some questions. First, obviously, it's a pleasure to be able to moderate this panel with good friends and colleagues and exceptional observers on Latin America and on issues of corruption. I wanted to just note, though, that the issue about the concern that's been expressed by both Ricardo and Todd about the efforts by some to move in a different direction, the fight against CSIC, the effort to throw CSIC out of the country. Those are efforts that would undermine the fight against corruption. And one of the things that we've just learned and is of particular concern, I think, and I'm going to raise the question, is that over the course of the last several months, many of the director of the National Police in Guatemala essentially has been fired. He was the first cop to come up from the ranks, and after training both in Guatemala and out with support from the US government, had really moved towards the goal of professionalizing the civilian police in Guatemala and making it a partner with the Fiscal General and with CSIC in going after corrupt practices. And on top of that, the Minister of Gobernacion also fired some 20 other top leaders of the national police, the top command, the head of criminal investigation, the head of operations. This is all in the last 6 months. 20 top police commanders have been fired. Another 100 police officers have been fired. And instead, you're seeing people come in who don't meet the criteria and being promoted, who have not gone through the kind of open competition and standards that the Guatemalan police had begun to put into place, critical in terms of the fight against corruption. And I would just note that at the beginning of this year, the US Ambassador Luis Arriaga applauded the work of the national police and noted that that homicides were down 32% in Guatemala since 2009. And he noted as well that the Guatemalan police, in partnership with CICI, had managed to reduce impunity for homicides and for corrupt and for violent crimes by almost 25%. And a month later, that national police director, Nettie Ramos, was fired by the Minister of Governance. So my first question is whether the two of you are concerned about an effort to roll back the anti-corruption movement in Guatemala, concerned both in terms of the institutions involved and obviously the impact on the economy.
You want me to go first? So here, what I would say is, obviously you don't want to see steps back from programs and projects that the United States government or the international community are involved with that you think are helping a country. You don't want to see that go back. But what I would say is what we've been engaged with, what the United States government has been engaged with, is understanding that, as we all know, elections have consequences, right? So what you want to do is build a system such that it doesn't matter what government is there, what administration is there. You want to build strong institutions, and that's what we've been trying to do, certainly since I've been involved with Guatemala. There's a former ambassador to Guatemala in the back row there, Steve McFarland. I was his DCM. Why don't you stand up? I was his DCM in Guatemala from 2009 to 2011. And then I went from Guatemala to work in our Bureau for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. And what I learned in Guatemala is it's the institutions that matter. And it's always been the institutions that have not been funded sufficiently in Guatemala. If you have institutions, as we do in the United States and other countries, if you have institutions that are strong and are independent and are accountable to its citizens, then it doesn't matter who the president is. It doesn't matter who the ministers are. The civil service, the federal service, by and large, is going to make sure that the practices continue that have always continued to protect those institutions and make them function. And we're not there yet in Guatemala. We're not there yet in Central America, but we're moving in the right direction. And I think it's important to stay positive on these things. You know, ministers are going to come and go, presidents are going to come and go, but the institutions are always going to stay there. And so I think it's important that we focus on the real work that needs to be done, which is making sure that you're hiring the right people, You're recruiting the right people, you're hiring the right people, you're giving them the right training, you're building institutions that are going to stay strong, and I think, I hope, in the end, attract foreign investment and domestic investment.
I start saying that corrupt people is powerful. Corrupt people is rich, and they are becoming richer and richer. They have a lot of resources. And I'm looking here at one expert in the issue, Roberto De Micheli. You have written many articles about how they are having the best party of their lives. So when a public prosecutor office, a general attorney, a UN commissioner comes in and shut down the lights and turn off the music of that hell of a party, of course they are going to resist. And of course they are going to try to use all their resources, which are many, many resources. Even a captured state, as Guatemala have sometimes looked like. You mentioned Mr. Ambassador 2004, but let's think 1978, 1993, when the self-coup d'etat in 93. So they are powerful, and of course, they are going to use all the resources, economic, of a politic nature, and all expressions of power to stop that and reverse the thing. Comisionado Velázquez said that the original sin of the Guatemalan democracy was funding a political party's campaign during election years, which is one of the main channels to get into powerful institutions. So I will identify in the current administration, I deeply regret to say, that the Minister of Public of Foreign Relations and the Minister of the Interior, or Ministerio de Gobernación, could be thought as the two main government agency in charge of trying to execute this reversal process of at Ministerio Público, because this is a tandem, Ministerio Público and CICIG. So I will say there is no doubt that is an interest, it is an effort, and sadly there are results on this effort of going backwards. One example is, I'm not an expert, and I really don't understand the dynamics of US policy here in Washington, D.C. But for me, it's very difficult to understand.
You feel alone.
Yeah, maybe. How come a committee in the Senate or the US Congress is discussing things about CICIG? And how come, it is my better understanding, that there is a temporary hold in US financing for CICIG, and they are thinking about the decision if this hold is going to be permanent or not? So this effort to going backwards in Guatemala is so strong, so powerful. They are dictating the agenda of some members of the US Congress and the US Senate. For me, that is difficult to understand and believe, but it's happening. So my answer is, it's going on.
I just want to stay with this for just a minute, because I think the US, as I understand it, the US government, one of the things that it did was invest a significant amount in professionalizing the national police and strengthening its capability to go after illegal armed groups, the SEACs, and has relatively been successful in helping to demobilize some of those groups. And let me put this in a hypothetical way. If in fact it turns out that the removal of top officials in the police and their replacement with people who don't have that kind of training, is it possible that that's going to result in an increase in the capability of those illegal armed groups again and their effort to take over local government. And that, I assume, would be a great concern to the United States.
Well, I think it's possible. But again, we have to look at the evolution, right? I mean, the national police in Guatemala has historically been seen with quite a bit of skepticism. That began to change mm-hmm. in 2011, 2012, as U.S. involvement in, and it, I want to be careful because this is not just the United States doing this. This is a concerted effort by the international community to help these countries. So if I mistake and say just the United States, one, it's because I'm getting older, but also, but it's important to recognize that this is just not the United States. We're doing this as a team with allies in the international community. Over time, the philosophy, the basis for the way people work changes as you do that training over years and years and years. There are more policemen now who recognize what it is to be a good policeman, those characteristics that are necessary to be a good policeman and do good investigations and help out with the Ministerio Público. And that attitude is going to strengthen the institution and change things. Are you gonna have setbacks? Of course you're gonna have setbacks. Look. Ricardo is absolutely right. Those groups that have been involved in corruption that has occurred over hundreds of years in Guatemala, they are not going to go away easily. Mm. And they have found a way to become part of the fabric of government, of economic and political life in Guatemala. The fight against corruption are like the white cells, and they are being attacked. These groups are gonna fight back, but I gotta tell you, I'm very positive about this. If you look at the, when I was in Guatemala from 2009 to 2011, nobody talked about the fight against corruption. We had five directors of the National Police in 2 years. Mm. All of them today are in jail. In 2 years, five directors of police, all of them are in jail. Today, if you look at social media, if you look at the front pages of the newspapers in Guatemala, if you look at the editorial pages, everything is about the fight against corruption. That is huge. This is, I think, a society that has said enough is enough. They started in 2004 saying enough is enough, and in 2015, they're actually doing the things, supporting those efforts that are making it work. And I think this is a good thing.
No question about it. Do you find that there are increasing numbers within the private sector, business community in Guatemala who are, as the ambassador indicated, beginning to say enough is enough?
Of course, absolutely. Our study is a typical economist exercise playing with numbers, but we started from one very important statement that we don't question the ethical standpoint, the starting point. Corruption is bad, and we really reject all those scholars that saying a little corruption is okay. I don't see any difference between little and big corruption. Mm-hmm. It's the same, and it's a cancer, and it's going to disseminate very quickly. So it's a matter of ethics, it's a matter of conscience. And within the Guatemalan private sector, there are very, very respectable and very good leaders among them. They are saying, even they are accepting that they were part of it. There is a huge case that Ministerio Público and CSIC put to trial, which is construction and corruption. And it's a case of big companies, construction companies, that illegally finance the campaign, the political campaign of Presidente Pérez Molina, and there is some doubts about also the campaign financing about of Presidente Jimmy Morales. And they were investigated, they were arrested, they were put to trial, and a group of them publicly to the judge said, look, when it is election year, if you want to be part of the corruption business, you must be corrupt. There is no other way. If you are not corrupt, you are out of business. So we publicly accept, I publicly accept, that I paid that money and I accept I did wrong. And I please accept the sentence and the punishment according to the law. They were sentenced with short sentence because they accepted their guilt. So that is a good example of how things are changing. Among them, one president of CACIF, the private sector associations and guilds organization. And he was in prison, and he accepted he paid illegal campaign financing. And he served the short sentence according to the law if he accepted it. They were guilty. So, yes, even with the setbacks, even with the very powerful effort to going backwards, things in Guatemala are changing. It is not a straight line. It's a more a zigzag.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
With some setbacks, and it's a constant fight. But I can look at some group of business people, business persons who are more aware that corruption is good for society and it's good for business also.
Some of the businessmen that you're talking about who acknowledged having been engaged in those kinds of activities and others who also have said enough is enough have come to Washington and made the case that if CSIG is removed, that it would be that the institutions are not strong enough now to withstand the power of those who want to go back to a system of a corrupt system. Do you agree with that? Start with you this time.
Absolutely. Many of the critique against CSIG is that it is only like a prosecutor investigating and spying people and trying to put people in jail. That is not true, really. They were highly involved in the proposal for the constitutional reforms. So, for example, there is a huge debate about in Guatemala about the preventive imprisonment, which, in fact, it is a problem, and it is unfair. Mm-hmm. That long preventive jail is against human rights. That is true. But it is not decided by CSIG. It is decided by the judges. Mm-hmm. And if you are a prosecutor and you are accusing someone of committing a crime, you have to hold your position. You are not to become soft because the judiciary or the justice administration system in Guatemala is fault. So CSIG was highly involved in the proposal to avoid and resolve that kind of structural problems. And I'm pretty sure to say that without CICIG, that proposal would not put together and present it to Congress. So it has two phases. Yeah, it has the phase of helping the public prosecutor office, but they are trying to transfer knowledge, modern techniques, and a modern sense of respecting the law culture in Guatemala. And I will say that surely Guatemalans, we are not ready to let CC go.
Ambassador?
There's a reason CICIG has broad bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. There's a reason CICIG receives broad international support around the world. There's a reason both Vice President Biden and Vice President Pence have said this, have expressed the same support for CICIG. There's a reason Secretary Kerry, Secretary Tillerson, and Secretary Pompeo have expressed support for CICIG. It works. It works. It is changing, positively changing society. Is it going to win the war against corruption? No. Should it be in Guatemala forever? No, of course not. But right now, all you have to do is look at the Guatemala that existed in 1978, in 1993, in 2004, in 2009 when I got there, and the Guatemala that exists post-2015. A Guatemala where people are actually starting to say to themselves, we can do this. We can go after these networks that have stolen our resources, that have forced irregular migration, that have allowed drug traffickers to use our land. This is not theoretical. ISEFI deals in the theoretical. What could happen if? I'm telling you to look at what Guatemala is today and what Guatemala was when I was there in 2009. Wholesale difference. Guatemalan society is different. And I think that's really, really important.
I think I'm going to open it up now for questions from the audience. Sir.
I'll try to project my voice.
Yeah, I think we have a mic coming for you right now.
I just to put my question in context, I'm Dan Crocker with the American Foreign Service Association, still active foreign service with the Commerce Department. And I've served in Latin America for the last 15 years. Ambassador, you mentioned a couple of secondary consequences as a result of the lack of economic growth and an adverse investment climate in Guatemala. Those are issues that the Trump administration is extremely sensitive to. Illegal migration flows, narco trafficking, general instability leading to a lack of economic security, which contributes to a lack of national security. It's part of their plan. Let's stipulate, because you've spent your career doing this, that the U.S. government has an active and constructive role to play on the ground in embassies and consulates in the region. Do you think we're making any headway? And I'd be interested in both of your opinions, Ricardo and you, Ambassador, in helping the Trump administration understanding the constructive role that a foreign service plays with AID programs, Foreign Service State Department and Commerce Department staffing on the ground. And do you think, Ricardo, that they, in fact, the U.S. government is playing a very active and constructive role there? Thank you.
So I would say on the first part of your question, I wouldn't isolate the Trump administration on this. My first president was Ronald Reagan. My first Secretary of State was George Shultz. See, I told you I was old. Every transition is different. Every transition is bumpy. You have people coming in who have no idea how the federal government works, how the Foreign Service works, how the civil service works, what the differences are. And there is always a period of getting accustomed to how the ship of state functions. You know, the federal government is like an aircraft carrier steaming through the ocean, and the new captain comes on board and says, I want to go that way. And the aircraft carrier goes very slowly in that direction because we know how hard it's going to be to get there. You have to lay the groundwork to get there with the governments that you're in, you're working with on the ground, with your other agencies in the interagency process, and then with other countries that may not want you to go in that direction. Every administration that I've been involved in, 32 years in the Foreign Service, every administration has gone through that period. Sometimes it's been shorter, sometimes it's been longer, but it always happens.
Go ahead. Very quickly, the Guatemalan current situation is quite complex because you cannot draw it simply as a cartoon with two colors. It has multidimensional, multicolor, and multi-everything aspects. So, yes, I think we Guatemalans, we Central Americans, because it's not only Guatemala. Think about Nicaragua, what's going on. Think about Honduras, think about El Salvador. Things are getting more and more complex. So, for example, in immigration or trade relations or other illicit and in crime activities like narco-trafficking, the U.S. government should keep on its efforts to better understand the roots of these complex things that are going on and to avoid taking measures that are only addressing to the final and most visible effects, not regarding the roots of it. And I will say that the relationship between Central America and Guatemala in particular with the US has been quite bumpy, to use your word, Mr. Ambassador. Think about 54, think about the 60s, the 70s. I will say today, the US is perceived by the general population as an ally, as a friend. Sometimes a friend that cannot understand fully what is going on, but it is a friend, not a foe.
Good, very good. We have three questions here. One, two, three.
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Sergio Martinez, and I am the chair of the Sustainable Development Committee at the United Nations Association of the National Capital Area. So I have a question for Ambassador Todd Robinson. In the light of the upcoming congressional elections here in the United States, do you anticipate any changes in the U.S. foreign policy towards Guatemala? For instance, do you have any thoughts about the plan for the Alliance of the Prosperity? Is the U.S. planning to prioritize anti-corruption, transparency, and accountability as part of that plan? Or what is the new direction? Thank you.
I'll take the other two and then.
Okay.
I wanted to thank you for the message that we need the rule of law efforts in Guatemala because speaking for Walmart, I'm Welby Lehman with Walmart. We need more and better efforts in that regard. It is the critical element that business needs as well. I want to put this conversation then in context, since we're talking about the economic development connection, to Douglas North, who has sort of a three-part institutional theory for economic growth, that you need formal rules, informal norms, and enforcement. So most of the discussion in Guatemala is about getting the enforcement right after a long time of not getting the enforcement right. What is being done, and is it being done well, to get the formal rules and the informal norms right? And the reason I mention that is because we think the devil's in the details here, and that although this is the critical thing you must do for economic growth, a lot of the details are really messy, and as a result, there is real occasional harm to economic activity. I'll use an example. One of the most senior people in the rule of law efforts in the Guatemalan in Guatemala once told us, "Can I give you some unsolicited advice? I wouldn't do business with any Guatemalan suppliers." That's terrible economic policy, not that person's job to do no economic policy, but rather other rule of law. But our view is that critical Douglas North aspect of informal norms requires the carrot to go with the stick. The United States often comes in the IP world. We saw the United States come in and try to get Latin America to build IP institutions by massive enforcement alone, and it just doesn't work. You need the carrot too. You need to get people to see the benefit. And we view our supply chain as one of the most critical carrots in getting people to have that informal conversion into a culture of rule of law. So,
just behind you.
Hi, Lizardo Bolaños, economist. I'm from Guatemala. I have my doubts regarding the empirical analysis, but we can leave that aside for later. My concern would be, shouldn't we thinking also about a second stage here? I'm concerned when you're talking about the public investment is low, and that is one of the drivers of economic growth, that we're not having a serious discussion about improving public servants' ability for them to provide quality service. I believe that it is not only about looking to the private sector. The public sector has diminished their efficiency. And having friends and family members in the public sector, I'm not confident that they're not experiencing fear of getting involved with following rules that make no sense, and that in the presence of recent reforms have not improved the environment of Guatemalan public sector. And I believe that is the leg that has not been introduced and can generate further problems because people are not necessarily happy. Thank you.
I'm going to knock out the congressional question
first.
Elections have consequences. Everybody should know that. Will there be massive changes in foreign policy after midterm elections in November? No, not likely. There aren't massive changes generally in foreign policy even after presidential elections. Every administration does something a little differently, but the federal government works in such a way that you have to project out what you're going to be doing, regardless of who the administration is. So generally, most programs, most projects continue at least until their end date. And then they start thinking about, you know, in AID, for instance, the next 5 years, something like that. So there won't be, I don't anticipate massive changes in foreign policy after either after the midterms or really after the presidential elections afterwards.
Before you go, as a commentator, I'm going to take exception to that in the following way, that you've had two budget proposals from the new administration. Both of those budget proposals propose somewhere between a 30 and a 40% reduction in USAID and in State Department. And that to me signifies, and hopefully it'll change, that the next budget will recognize the first, that the Congress rejected those proposals for massive cuts, and second, that the reason that the Congress rejected them, bipartisan, remember with the Republican majority in the Congress, the reason is that they understood that what we characterize as soft power has important impact in terms of US national security interests and U.S. economic interests in the regions where we work, and that therefore those proposals were contrary to what the Congress thought, and what some of us also agree, our international interests. So that's my only.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Look, you can't do the country's business without people.
Yeah, exactly.
And but I would also say, you know, we've had other administrations that have cut the numbers and
sure.
cut the funding as well. So it's not
30-40%.
No, but it's not. You know, again, it's not. I want to guard against this idea that it's one administration over another, because it's not. And you know, this is something that that we have to figure out the best way to adapt with the resources we have.
No argument.
But you're right. You can't do what we need to do without people. You can't do what we need to do without resources.
Right.
And perhaps the most important thing, you can't do what we need to do without training. The world is getting more complex every minute. The United States should want diplomats that can quickly understand that and figure things out. I think we've done a pretty good job of that, certainly over the course of my time at the State Department. We have some extraordinary diplomats around the world, and maybe one of the silver linings of the whole WikiLeaks thing is that people got to see how extraordinary the United States diplomats are around the world. The depth of our contacts, the breadth of our relationships, that doesn't happen overnight. And it doesn't happen without resources, and you can't do it by a drone.
Right. Agreed. Ricardo?
I like your approach of three blocks, the formal rules, informal rules, and enforcement. Guatemala, and I will say the whole Central America, has tried to advance in the three blocks, with differences among countries and differences and the diversity of results. Talking about Guatemala, there have been huge steps in formal rules, but there are still some debate. For example, on last Friday, the Constitutional Court admitted and ruled a temporary suspension for the regulation of the tax administration access for bank information. And this was because a company, an importer of chicken, is being investigated by the tax administration and is getting, we say, big animal steps behind him. So that will be an example of the formal rules. Same as El Salvador, Costa Rica has a serious problem with formal rules, I will say. The role of the constitutional courts and tribunals, it should be a question of more deep analysis. There is a huge challenge in enforcement. Because, like the transit law, I really think that the Guatemalan transit law is not a bad one. It's fairly okay. But if you see the streets, the transit is not good at all. So there is a serious problem of enforcement. Tax, like legislation, is a problem. Which leads me to the middle point, the informal rules. And yeah, that is a very interesting and challenging issue, because it has to do with legitimacy. And think about the informal sector in the Guatemalan or in the Salvadorian or Honduran economy. Why people are in the informal sector? Many, because they are so poor. that don't have enough income to be treated like formal economic agents. But many because of distrust of the government and the authorities. And that is a very important rule, informal rule, trust. And we can go further for it. And for your question, I will say that enforcement in Central America has many faces. And one very concerning face is public service, the public servants. And there is no question about the need of improving. Remember that our talk about the execution, the budget execution problems related with institutional capability. And most of those of that institutional capability is the public servants, where they are not trained enough, they are not protected because their contracts are for professional services and not with the all the rights, and the problem of workers' union that some in Central America have been deformed in other things that is not a normal, necessary, and healthy workers' union organization. So, for example, the public procurement reforms that were approved in 2015 and 2016 in Guatemala, in my opinion, are the correct format rules. For example, the law introduced the inverse electronic ocean for public procurement, but people at the public service just don't like to make new things. They are afraid, or simply it's too complex to learn it, or maybe they are in the corruption, and because it is a more transparent way to do things, they've rejected it. There are very complex combination factors. So you are right. That needs a double click and more detailed analysis. Yes, you're right.
I would also say one of the first issues that I came across when I got to Guatemala in 2009 was this idea of a civil service law. And everybody said, oh, we've got this great civil service law sitting in Congress.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I left in 2017, guess where that civil service law was? Sitting in Congress. And it's still sitting there. Right. There are reasons for that, right. Yeah. Obviously. Because once you have a trained civil service, a huge mechanism for corruption goes out the window. And I would argue that much of the corruption that has been allowed to exist over the years, corruption and impunity that has been allowed to exist over the years, comes from the fact that there's no accountability. If you've only got a contract for every year or every 2 years, you're going to go in, take whatever you can, and then you're out. So.
There, the last question here, at last two questions. Right, one in front and one right behind him. And while you're doing that, I just should add, recall what Michael Matera said at the outset, that what we're trying to do in the project that we have at CSIS is to bring some of the experience from Chile and Uruguay, particularly on civil service reform, into Central America, Northern Triangle countries, and not merely what they did, but how they did it. And that goes back to building a political coalition, civil society, private sector, that recognizes that fundamentally the economy benefits when you have an effective civil service, one where they do have rules about how they have to operate and how they can be held accountable.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Mark. Mike Jagy from George Mason University Peace and Stability Ops Program. I'd like to ask two related questions, a short-term threat to CSIG and the longer-term threat. The threat that you mentioned, the hold by Senator Rubio on U.S. funding for CSIG, could you give us any sense for how that can be addressed? The second long-term threat to me is that the mandate is only 2 years, and the institutional reform problem and challenge is multi-year. When Morales came into office, he extended the mandate for an additional 2 years, you know, what's the status of that, and what would happen if he were to say, look, since you're investigating me, you're no longer needed. The reform that you mentioned is really critical, the constitutional reform on the process for naming judges and the Attorney General. That will require years, so how can we deal with that?
Right behind you.
Thanks, Mark. Maureen Taft-Morales, Congressional Research Service, and it's related to your question. There's long been broad bipartisan support of CSIG in Congress, as you mentioned. The government of Guatemala and others are lobbying to curtail CSIG funding, and so I'm wondering why you think that that bipartisan support is faltering right now, resulting in things like the hold. So that's question one. And then the other is regarding the hold. Ambassador Merton said in a hearing that their State Department found no evidence of collusion between CSIG and any Russian elements in the Bitkov case, which was the allegation that led to the hold. So I'm wondering where conversations stand between the administration and those findings and Congress regarding the status of the hold on that money for CSIG.
Take those two together.
Yeah. So what I've said publicly is that I continue to support CSIG. The US government continues to support CSIG. I continue to think that there is broad bipartisan support on Congress for CSIG. And I believe we will find a solution to the hold. Ambassador Merton was exactly right. There was no collusion. But I think you have to take the administration at its word. The Vice President has spoken publicly his support for CSIG, Secretary of State. The Assistant Secretary Designate has expressed support for CSIG. The Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement has expressed support for CSIG. My sense is there will continue to be support for CSIG, and we continue to see the value, the incredible resource it has been over the years in helping Guatemala move in the right direction on the fight against corruption. So that's thing number one. On the mandate, you have to remember that this is a treaty between Guatemala and the United Nations. So if they wanted to change the mandate, it would have to happen in a negotiation between Guatemala and the United Nations. I would not lightly reopen the mandate. And I think I'll just leave it at that.
Just briefly, there is a serious danger in those talks here at the Senate and the Congress. And we maybe can discuss it with Roberto and Michele, but in my personal opinion, and it is many's opinion, part of the success of CSIG is a central, a critical characteristic of CSIG, which is its independence. It is a real, all sufficiently proved, a real independent body. So there is not only the hold. It's not only a question of money. It's a question of changing how the agreement between the Guatemalan government and the United Nations is written. Because there is floating around a proposal that the government can appoint a co-commissioner to watch out the commissioner. That is a way to breaking the back of an independent body. So I will add that we hope that not only the question of the hold is solved, but these discussions about renegotiation, the agreement between the government and the United Nations, at least keeps on touch the most valuable characteristic, which is independence.
The only thing I would add to that is no one and no institution is perfect. We can all get better, and that would include CSIG. And if there are ways to make it better and more efficient, I don't think it's a bad thing to explore them. But
of course,
the fundamental aspect here is this is always going to be a negotiation between the government of Guatemala and the United Nations. And at the end of the day, the government of Guatemala, whatever government is there, is going to get what it wants.
Of course.
So we just, you know, we need to be clear on that. Now, hopefully, what we have is a government that recognizes the value of this institution and wants to continue to work on those areas with this institution that that can improve and can help the country. But at the end of the day, you know, this is a government to international organization agreement, and we have to always have that in the back of our mind. This is not something we own. This is not something the international community owns. It's something that we will support as long as it continues to work towards those ends that we all agree are important.
I'm going to conclude this session with just one final comment, which is that the ambassador indicated that there's bipartisan support and support from the administration for CSIG to continue to carry out the kind of work that it has done over the course of the past 10 years. And I would simply add that throughout this process, the international community represented by the United States, other donors who provided the support, have understood that the independent nature of CSIG is critical to its success in advancing toward the goals that we all share. And hopefully that will continue to be the case. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another curated conversation from CSIS. Tune in next week for more. And remember, you can explore all of our events online at csis.org.